I'm Tiffany Jordan, WPFW's Development Director. And you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington. Good evening, Washington, D.C., and America, and welcome to the Raucous Caucus. Join the fray as we broadcast live from the golden studios of WPFW 89.3 FM Pacifica. Join Terry, Mark, and Garland as they boldly go where no commentators have gone before to inform, even save the nation with wit, wisdom, and sagacity on the Raucous Caucus.
Good evening and welcome to another edition of the Raucous Caucus.
My name's
Garland Nixon.
This is Terry Kester on the West Coast.
Things are going downhill. Mark!
Mark, where?
And I am here as well. Welcome, welcome, welcome.
And Mark, what venue might you find yourself in?
I am in New York City. We are coast to coast tonight.
Hey, check this out.
East Coast, I'm West Coast. You're in the center, which I never quite thought you would be.
Yeah, I'm far over to the left, so I guess I'm probably in Nova Scotia or somewhere relative to this crew.
That's not to your left.
I thought you were in the Golden Studios of WPFW.
Oh, wait a minute. Terry's out on the West Coast. That would be to my left. I don't know.
That would be to your left. Yes. Try to keep this straight, guys.
I kind of like Canada. Things are nice in Canada. They've got universal health care and everything. Why don't we agree with Canada?
Yeah.
Universal
hey guys, we got to get going here right away because we got a fantastic show.
Hey, we're going to be
first off, we got to thank. This is a little bit belated, but okay. We got to thank all those who contributed to the Raucous Caucus.
Oh, that's right.
And contributed to WPFW in the recent pledge drive. So we really, really do thank you and appreciate everything you do. And
uh-oh.
We now have fantastic news, guys, to our listeners. They're going to get
Obama's won already.
You, Garland. You, Mark. And yours truly, debate tonight before the presidential debate.
Woo!
I mean, talk about excitement. And at approximately, well, let me first say this. First of all, we're going to, just so our listeners know, because things are going to get hectic here. I know that's unusual in the Raucous
Caucus. Yeah, that's right.
They probably already started that.
It probably did. But first, we're going to discuss the debates themselves a little bit. For about 10 minutes. Then we're going to discuss how to start a war in the Middle East. Everybody's goal seems to be both candidates' goal. Then we will discuss for a little bit the economy. And then we're going to open the phone lines from that time. It'll be about 7:35, 7:40 at the latest. We're going to open the phones to our listeners so that they can call in, keep the phones open, and keep on Raucous Caucusing with them right up until 9 o'clock, until the debates start.
Terry, you buried the lead. You buried the lead. We have a two-hour Raucous Caucus tonight.
Oh, I know.
Woo!
I mean, it just makes you warm and money all over.
Tonight.
It really does.
We're going to give them twice the sagacity and all of the chocolatey, sweet, sugary goodness of a normal show.
Oh, what more
and,
could you
and
ask?
And you won't miss an inch of the debate.
Yeah. And when we get to the callers, I just want to, you know, what part of the goal is to have them suggest what question they would be asking the presidential candidate, since tonight's debate with those guys is going to be a town hall. And we're going to outbound their hall.
It's the Raucous Caucus town hall, pre-town hall, the debate town hall.
Hey, Terry, are we going to have a rule tonight? When you call in, no yelling and name calling?
That would be a good rule.
I think maybe we ought to start with that after the last couple of weeks of calls.
Yeah. How about a little niceness? I mean, that would help.
Calling Dom the white supremacist.
Yeah, that's right.
It doesn't work.
I'm sick of being called a white supremacist.
and we're sick of seeing you called a white supremacist. Believe me. Okay, guys, let's jump into the topics real quickly here. Debates. Let me make a couple of points, then I want to get your response. One. I think the debates, the last time's debates, I know you probably disagree, was a mess and a disaster. Its primary accomplishment is all it did was raise anxiety. Two, the after effect matters. If Romney wins, all who voted for President Obama will be in despair. If President Obama wins, all who voted for Romney will be very angry and possibly violent. And in any case, whoever wins, neither party is being honest about the economy, and if there is any recovery, it'll be very slow, if at all. And the final point, guys, our campaign mania is actually murdering our representative democracy. Americans actually now think campaigning is governance. Garland?
First of all, you can't kill something that's already dead. I don't think it's murdering it. Secondly, I do agree with you on a lot of issues. I mean, the debates.
Wow.
You know, there was a guy today on, I mean, you know, there was a guy on TV. I forgot what was the day, whatever, CNN or whatever. They were interviewing this guy. He was undecided. The person was undecided. At this point, they were undecided. And I just think to myself, at this point, how, you know, if the debates are going to change your mind, maybe you shouldn't vote. Maybe you're so far out there in la la land. If the debates are going to change your mind, if you don't know where these two can, the guy, and you know, God forbid, I hope he's not listening somewhere out there, but not to insult this poor individual, but the guy said that they asked him what was important to him, and he said Pell Grants. And they basically asked him, what are the two candidates, what are their positions on Pell Grants? And he didn't know. 3 weeks before the election, he's undecided. Pell Grants is a big issue to him because he's trying to go back to school, but he doesn't know what the busy, I'm lost. So the debates, you know, it's sad to me. It's unfortunate to me that the debates really can move the numbers because you got to be ignorant of the policies of both candidates in order to be influenced by these debates, in my humble opinion.
And as you gentlemen, know, the number of undecided has grown a lot, so they are the ones that are going to be influenced. Mark?
As usual, the two of you are pessimists and I am optimists. You are glass half empty. And I am glass half full. I don't know about you, I loved the Biden-Ryan debate. I enjoyed every minute of it.
Oh, good.
Liked Joe Biden's winning smile. May have been a little too much, but if you recall, last week I said the best way to deal with a bunch of liars is not to get angry, sorry Obama, not to sigh, sorry Al Gore, but just to laugh it off and scoff at their nonsense, and Joe Biden did that in spades. And when Martha Raddatz asked Paul Ryan to get specific, and he couldn't do it, and she asked him again, and he still couldn't do it, I was howling. And when Joe Biden mentioned, you know, Paul Ryan condemned the stimulus, and then Joe Biden said, really, I got two letters from you asking me for money, I loved the debate. I thought it was great, and I think if Obama can get half, because all is too much, but get half of the energy and optimism and sunny disposition of Joe Biden tonight, he's got this election walk away.
Hey, Mark, just to say real quick, before we get back, Terry gets back, I've truly enjoyed the debate. I loved it. It was fun. It was great showmanship, and it, you know, kind of separated the big dogs from the little puppies. I enjoyed it, but I think it's a sad statement that that these debates actually move the numbers.
But Garland, not everybody lives and breathes politics 24 hours a day like you, me, and Terry. Some people have lives to lead. We don't, but they do. They've got to take care of their kids and their parents, so they've got to work every day, and they don't have the luxury of worrying about politics 24/7. They're using the debates, and I'm fine with that. That's part of the way the whole system works. If they're listening in, then good for them.
Are you talking about the 47%?
One quick point, Mark. I mean, got to back up here a little bit. Mark called us pessimist again. You know how that hurts
us. I did.
Yeah, I'm crushed personally.
Yeah, I'm weeping here, but you know, and he used that feeble half glass, you know, full half full glass analogy. And as you and I think pointed out a couple
you
of shows ago,
glass,
I think
right,
Mark
Terry?
Was in, Mark was traveling around the world or something, and we pointed out that if that glass is got toxic drink in it, who gives a darn if it's half full or
it's half full of hemlock.
But anyway, Mark, I understand your point. I understand your point, and the Marks were enthusiastic. But Garland, don't you think it actually all that tension, and there was lords of tension, don't you think that actually raised anxiety rather than educated the public?
I don't know. The thing about it is because there are people watching the debates who, as Mark said, who really and you know what? This is not to denigrate people who don't know about politics, because what's unfortunate is that when you have difficult times, there are a lot of people who are just trying to make it and trying to survive.
Yep.
And now the American dream has become, for a lot of people, the American dream is now being able to pay your bills and make it another month. So there are a lot of people that they don't have time. They're working two jobs. They're trying to make it. And, you know, maybe they have to turn on this stuff to get it. Maybe they, you know, to figure out what's going on. But I think it's unfortunate because you've got people who are voting against their interests. You've got people, I'll say this a million times, a $30,000 a year transmission mechanic voting for somebody worth $200 million who says their platform is to cut taxes for people worth $200 million. And they think this person represents their needs and their values. And it's going to look out for them.
It really is what's sad. And we got to remember that only about 3% of the population is in any way politically aware. I mean, that's just a sad fact. So they're obviously being swayed by things that are not relevant. Mark, a quick one more point for you about the debates, and then we're going to go to war.
Before you go to war, Terry, let me say this.
If Romney wins, it'll take us about another month to go to war.
In the town hall format tonight, President Obama is very good because it's real at hearing somebody out and talking to them and talking to their needs and really understanding the way average, ordinary Americans, working class, middle class Americans, poor Americans think, because he's been all of that. And Romney has a real hard time. He's going to have to fake it to pretend to understand someone who makes under $100 million a year. I think that if President Obama, again, will show half the kind of spirit that Joe Biden showed last week, I think he'll do fine, because I think he is real in a way that, let's face it, Mitt Romney is fake. I mean, when he gives that little fake smile as he's listening in, pretending to care, it's so obviously fake to me. I actually noticed Paul Ryan trying to do the same half smile. He did it as badly as his boss.
I think
the town hall format is the perfect way for Obama to bat out of the park. I am optimistic.
Right,
I think he's going to do it.
What's that, Terry?
I'm sorry?
What did you say about Paul Ryan?
We got to remember, I mean, the smile may not have worked, you know, for Paul Ryan, but he does have that real cute little widow's peak, you know, right in the center of his head, that little hair.
The one that they scraped off on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Okay, guys, it's time to go to war.
Okay.
You know, it's what America does best. And, you know, we really kind of love it. And let's face it, the nice thing about war is it's simple.
And guess what, Terry? I'm using verbal drones tonight. So you and Mark are in our world. You guys better be looking out your windows, buddy.
We are.
I didn't tell you where I was specifically.
I just kind of want to discuss, you know, where we're headed in the Middle East, because everybody is pushing. There's no question about it. And, you know, as we know, besides, you know, having a military that's always itching to use its tools, that all you need to start a war is one, talk, and two, all you got to do after that is name your enemy, and then you got to just denigrate that enemy for years and years and years and years and increase the threat level in people's minds, and boom, there and boom, all of a sudden you got a war. And we've even gone so far, and Mark, I know you're probably going to be a little ticked at this, but I want to talk about it.
Oh, I'm going to disagree with you both tonight on this, I'm sure, but go ahead.
Okay. But, you know, now we're even advertising war. And I'm talking about those advertisements that are in the subways in New York and in Washington, D.C., and the courts have decided they have the right to do this, and I guess they do. These subway advertisements that say, quote, in any war between the civilized man and the savage support the civilized... In any war between civilized man and the savage, support the civilized man. Support Israel. Defeat jihad. These say advertisements in New York and Washington subways. Guys, we're talking ourselves into a war. Mark?
Well, I'm not going to defend the advertisements. I want to be fair. The advertisements are not United States government advertisements. They're an advertisement of a pretty radical person who I, in fact, have argued with personally on Fox News, Pamela Keller, who is not in any way mainstream. I mean, look, I'm a big supporter of Israel. You know that. I've never hidden that fact. I would never suggest that anyone are savages. This kind of simplistic rendering of some very complex, very interesting things going on in the Middle East. There are battles in the Middle East between moderate Muslims and extreme Muslims, between the Salafis, the fundamentalists, and the Muslim Brotherhood, and Hezbollah, and Iran, and Sunnis, and ordinary people trying to live their lives. And it's fascinating, and it's complex, and I'm more than willing to chat about all those things. But to try to simplify it as good, bad, good, evil, that just doesn't make any sense. I do think there's some gray there, and I think that some on the left make it black and white in the other direction. It's just simply not black and white, and I'm more than willing to talk about the intricacies of it. But the first thing I want to make clear is it's all gray. And there's good people of every religion, of every culture, of every place on earth, and there's bad people of every religion, of every culture, of every ethnicity on earth. That's just a basic fact. Let's start there, and then we can talk about the specifics of each individual problem.
Yeah, and you know, and what I'm talking about, talking about war, I know that starts a war. Both candidates, again, in fact, all the candidates are just, you know, talking about punishing Iran, punishing Iran, punishing Iran. The reason is, and I just want to point this out and then get to Garland, you know, we accuse Iran, you know, of terrorism. And what we call terrorism, guys, we got to face, is what they call defending their interest. That's the same thing we do, that America does. Garland.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny Mark mentions Pam Geller because I basically argued. And you guys know I'm a pretty cool, calm, collective guy. And
you are?
Yes. And on Fox News, on national TV, I lost it. Lost it with Pam Geller. And I let
right,
her have
she's,
it.
She's
really psycho.
Extreme.
Yeah, she is. And I mean, and the idea, see, when you call people savages, let me tell you where that goes back, where that hits home here. When colonial countries invaded Africa, they called the people savages. When the colonial, yep. When they came and they invaded the Native Americans who were minding their own business, they called them savages. Dehumanized people, which makes it perfectly okay to kill them. They are not humans. They're not normal new human beings. They're savages. That is the most contemptible, evil thing. And I don't like to use the term evil when I'm talking to politics. But to me, this is not about politics when you start calling people savages. But that's Pam Geller. I think she's got a website called Atlas Shrugs or something. But that woman, her.
What's the connection with Garland with the American Freedom Defense Initiative?
I don't know. If they're dealing with Pam Geller,
because they are the ones who defended
Pam Geller's
in court.
The one who put up those ads in the Metro.
She's a
it's her organization, just so we know.
I'm sorry, Mark.
Her peeps who did that.
Yeah, she's real bad news. She's in a very
but
angry
that being
angry.
Said, and
it
I'm
is
never
the American
Geller,
Freedom Defense Initiative.
I'm also not going to defend the government of Iran. I want to be very clear here. I the people of Iran are some of the most pro-American, pro-Israel, Western-supportive people in the Middle East. As you know, they did a Green Revolution. They tried to overthrow the repressive government. They did not succeed. I am all supportive of the people of Iran. But I'm not supportive of their government, and I don't think the Iranian people are supportive of their government either. I do support the sanctions. I think Obama is doing good to do the sanctions, and my hope is the sanctions will take us away from the brink of war. So I want to be very clear. It's ridiculous and stupid and racist to call Muslims savages at the same time. That doesn't mean we have to support every dictatorship government on earth, and I do not support the Iranian government or the Syrian government, which has now murdered 30,000 innocent people.
Let me ask you this, Garland, you can answer first because
okay.
I just heard from Mark, too, but... You know, what right do we have, actually, what right do we have, or power, to forbid any country from developing a nuclear weapon? I know there's a non-proliferation treaty.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it.
That Iran signed.
Yeah, and let me say this.
As far as I know, and as far as I know, with Iran claiming and apparently demonstrating so far that it's for nuclear power, not for nuclear weapons, they are in accordance with that treaty.
Right.
What
not
power
according
do we
to
have
the IAEA,
to
not
okay.
according to International, International Atomic Energy Agency, which is a branch of the United Nations and is definitely not controlled by the U.S., according to them, Iran is breaking their treaty, and they're not allowing the IAEA to inspect. And that's not our government saying so. That's an international body controlled by the United Nations. So
uh-oh, Mark, you're breaking up. Mark, you're breaking up a little bit. I don't know if you're moving
well,
or something.
He just got too excited
That's what it is. But let me say this, Terry. I tend to agree with you, and there's some questions you have to ask. Okay, so we're going to say Iran or no country unless we determine can develop nuclear weapons, which nuclear weapons aren't a good thing. I'm completely against them. I don't think we should have them, but... How long did we do that? Did we do that for the next 10 years, for 100 years, 300 years, 400 years from now? God forbid if global climate change doesn't kill us all, which it probably will. But in the unlikely event that our species survives, that we continue to do that the next 200-300 years? I mean, to me, it's a very short-sighted thing. I'm not thrilled about Iran having nuclear weapons, don't get me wrong, or anyone else. However, I don't think that we or anyone else has a right to invade another country, to attack another country, to stop them from doing that. For God's sake, Russia had 1,000 nuclear weapons pointed at us, thousands of nuclear weapons pointed at us for 30 or 40 years, and we managed to get through that. Number one. Number two, if there's one thing you'll notice about the rulers of Iran, the real rulers of Iran, which are four or five really old mullahs, they're old. They didn't get old being suicidal. I do not, and I'll say this, I do not believe, and this is my part of my point. In any way, shape, or form, that if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, that they're going to lob it at a country that has 300 of them. I don't believe for one second. I think that's why people have to say they're insane, because you have to make the point that they're crazy to believe something that crazy. I don't believe that a bunch of old guys are going to say, well, let's, you know, that'd be like me getting in the ring with Mike Tyson and kicking him in the groin. Guess what's going to happen, buddy?
That wouldn't be a good idea.
I probably ain't going to survive that one.
You know, and in fact, I don't know if you saw the interview on CBS on 60 Minutes. I think it was 60 Minutes. Anyway, it was an interview with, I can't pronounce his name, so I won't try, the president of Iran.
Ahmadinejad.
Thank you. Very good, Garland. Oh, God, I'm glad you're on the air.
I think he's a schmuck, personally. Yeah. I consider him a schmuck. Class A
but
schmuck.
Anyway, he made that exact same point that you're making. He basically said, what, do you think we're crazy? We would use a nuclear weapon against somebody that's got 300 and the United States that's got 10,000? And I said, we're not suicidal. We're not crazy. He made exactly that same point.
Well, here's
what about Syria?
Iran
what the heck are we going to do about Syria?
Well, here's the thing. Because of Iran, Syria has now murdered 30,000 innocent people. They are likely to murder another 30,000.
What do you mean because of Iran?
People.
Yeah, I don't understand.
Hold on, Mark. Slow down there. What do you mean because of Iran? Isn't that a little radical?
Syria is funded by Iran. It exists because of Iran and Russia. Hezbollah exists, and it's actually going and fighting for the dictator of Assad. You have a religious war between the Alawi and the Sunni. It's becoming a civil war. And what's happening is the al-Qaeda elements there are getting weapons, largely to fight Assad. We think that by staying out, that by doing nothing, by letting, so what if 30,000 innocent people are killed, it doesn't bother us? Let me tell you, that comes back to haunt us. Because when we just let all those innocent people die, we find out, first of all, an entire world hates us. One of the reasons that the Libyans love us and the Syrians are starting to hate us is because we helped the Libyans. We didn't help the Syrians. And I am not arguing for invasion. I do not support invasion. But I do think that when a guy is basically shooting and killing, and I'm not talking about killing fighters, they're going door to door and killing children. I mean, it's really, really brutal what they're doing.
And apparently
here.
Now they're
using
cluster
bombs. And I think we have to be on the right side. You know, I supported when they did the Rwanda genocide. I was angry at the United States for not doing anything about it. Cambodian genocide, Darfur, Bosnia, you name it. I'm consistent. I'm against mass murder.
Okay, but the point
is,
Romney and President Obama got into this, but I think
when that's going on, we should do something about it.
Okay, Romney and President Obama got into this in one of the debates, and they'll probably get in again, and they'll beat it to death and not say anything significant, and they'll repeat each other and try to top each other on who's going to be the tough guy, who's got the biggest you-know-what. But the point is, what can really be done? There's no question about the horror. There's no question that the sanctions are necessary.
No fly zone. Three words. I'm not arguing for an invasion. I do not support invasion. I did not support the invasion of Iraq. Let the people of Syria fight their own battles. But we can help give them a little bit of arms, and we can shoot down planes when they're strafing villages. When the Syrian Air Force is using its own planes to bomb its own villages and kill civilians, I think that we can use a little bit to help shoot them down. And I think we win back. Not only are we stopping murder, mass murder, which is the main reason, but I actually think we win some friends. That Arabs understand, Muslims understand that we fight for them too, that we care about justice, that we don't like to see people being massacred.
Basically saying, you know, we probably should just get in there and bomb living hell.
Number one, I don't, with good reason, I don't think the Middle Easterners trust the U.S. I mean, you know, let's face it, after what happened in Iraq and you know, some of the horrors that we were a part of there. Overall, I don't think the Middle Easterners trust America, and with very good reason. So we have to be careful, because what we don't want to do is continue a Middle Eastern policy that we've worked for many years that has always been counterproductive. You know, time and again, we've intervened. We have support. And see, here's where we've gone wrong. We have supported brutal dictators over
but
and
this
over.
Is our
why
chance
would
to support the good guy?
So no, my point I agree to some extent. So why would they trust us? See, now we have a problem. They don't trust us. So and why
they
would they start now?
They trust us in Libya.
Yeah, well,
the people in Libya.
What is it, 2.5 million people?
Like us.
Well, now you say they trust us, but at the same time, you know, this group of people killed our ambassador there.
That's true.
You know, now,
but
you can say it's a small group of people, and it's just, you know, terrorists and all that, but no terrorist group, as you know, can exist unless there's a culture that to some degree supports that terrorism.
I don't
deny
that.
All in love
and
with
my whole point is
great. No,
and my point is,
and they're certainly not all
countries.
In love with us in
you
Egypt.
Have peaceful people and non-peaceful people. American, anti-American people. But in Libya, after that brutal, horrible terrorist attack by that militia, Ansar al-Sharia, the people of Libya rose up and they overran that militia and they kicked that militia out of Libya, telling you that the average Libyan is very thankful for what we did for them.
So,
and I think Obama did the right thing in Libya. I really do, and I think we could do something similar in Syria.
So the question arises, here's the question we're kicking around a little bit, and that is, how much do we intervene militarily in Middle Eastern affairs? And I think that's always been the question. And I think traditionally we have gotten it wrong almost every time. So I do think to some extent, I think what's going on in Libya, and I'll give President Obama credit. I think he's stepping lightly. I do know, and we've heard that they are arming the Libyan opposition to some extent.
Yep.
But I think the U.S. is stepping very lightly and being very reluctant to get involved. And I kind of, because of what we've done in the past has never worked. And because we've gotten over involved and in a lot of innocent people end up dying. I agree with President Obama in Syria in that we have to step very, very lightly.
One of the things that I really respect about President Obama is his seeming, not always, and there's covert activity going on that we don't even know about, but at least his seeming and his public restraint and his efforts to get in the international community. And I really do think, guys, because Romney loves simple answers to every part of his life. I mean, that's part of what his faith is, and that's part of what his politics are. And war is a simple answer. Garland, do you really believe that we'll go to war if Romney's president?
I do. There's no question. There's a couple things going on there.
I don't think there's that big a difference between them.
I do.
Think Romney talks a lot, but I don't see. He does say he's going to give another $2 trillion to the military that we don't need, can't afford, the military doesn't want. But I don't, in terms of the rhetoric, Romney's rhetoric is hotter than Obama's,
yes,
which I think is a mistake. But in terms of actual differences on the ground, I don't hear much. Romney says he'll stay in Afghanistan forever. Obama will get our troops out in 2014. There's a difference.
Let me tell you, I can give you a difference.
Romney kind of says, because Romney says everything, that, well, I might take our troops home. I just don't want to say when I'm going to do it. Romney's position is always, I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to do. Vote for me, and you'll find out. But I don't find anything he's actually said that's particularly different from what Obama said.
I can tell you
except
something.
Somebody made a really good point, and I forget who it was. It was either a columnist or somebody on the air, I'm not sure which, that that Romney is doing exactly the same thing that Bush did. And that is, you know, run and campaign, you know, for the first part as this totally conservative nut job and supporting all the conservative movements. Then go to the middle for the debates and everything else and try to show that you're
a warm,
wonderful beer-drinking guy. And, of course, Romney isn't a beer-drinking guy. And then when you get in office, the same as Bush did, you just resort back to that person that you probably are closer to being, which is this conservative nut job.
I was going to make a very important point. And when you say, what is Mitt Romney going to do? Let's look under the hood. If you want to know what he's going to do, his foreign policy is going to be, look under the hood. About three-quarters of his advisors are neocons from the Bush administration. So if you want to guess what Mitt Romney's going to do, all you have to do is look 4 years back to the Bush administration. Three-quarters of his advisors, a significant number of his advisors, are the neocons. We already know they never saw a war. They never saw a military engagement that they didn't approve of.
I think, too, it's important to remember that as we keep on talking about it, whether it's in the debates or whatever, we are creating a national mood for war.
The same as we did
in Iraq.
Yep.
You know, and this has nothing to do with, you know, trying to help Syria. I think we should fund Syria's rebels to the nth degree.
Hey, guys.
And maybe that's it. But the point is we are talking about war the same way we talked about the Iraq war, so that when it finally happens, the America goes, oh, goody, and the media goes right along with them.
We're going to have to take a break, guys. We're running up on the half hour. You're listening to WPFW 89.3 FM. The number, call in for the next hour and a half.
Not yet.
Not yet, not quite yet. Okay, in about 5 or 10 minutes. You're listening to 89.3 FM WPFW here in Washington, D.C. This is the Raucous Caucus. We'll be back in a minute.
Bye. Ease off long, because, well, me there in Washington, D.C. Boy, I'm here listening to a radio station called WPFW. And here, well, me here see them pan 89.3 FM. Boy, I'm here see them rough. But here, well, now, boy, I'm here see them look some money and some sponsorship. You know what I mean? But don't feel, sir, them are grabby for money. Because everything, and you know what I mean? Them support the community, so I don't have to support them saying. So, if I don't want to no hear no gimmicks, and I don't want to hear pure lyrics and good music, send some donation, man. Yeah.
Holy moly! My name's Garland Nixon, and I'm right here with... Oh, I think I'm here with...
Background. Did we lose that? Golly, I don't even know how to be inspired without that music.
Holy moly.
Well, and Mark Levine. Okay. Did you hear me? Did I
all
say
right,
it?
Guys, we got just a few minutes here because I want to introduce one other topic real quickly, and that is the economy, because obviously they're going to talk us to death on that. And my point is neither Obama or Mitt Romney or any other politician for that matter is really being honest about our situation, our economic situation. And that's why neither of them has really any kind of plan. The fact is the whole world has slid into a new paradigm over the last few decades.
Yep.
It is a economy that exists is the world economy. And we're caught in it just like every other nation. And let me give you an example here. There's a small network of corporations that actually run the whole damn thing. Listen to this fact. There are now 43,600 transnational companies. But of those, there's a mere 147 companies, corporations, that control 40% of the world's wealth. And it's totally unregulated, and they ain't going to give it back. Mark?
And how many of those does Romney own? 5, 10?
Yeah, right.
6.
103? I was just wondering.
Well, you know, you're right about something. There's a new paradigm. And, I do think what's unfortunate is there are people who are blaming President Obama for a lot of things, that have basically come to a head as he was coming into office. And I think that's unfair. I do think that, when you look at what's interesting is when you look at the recovery and people say there was no recovery. In fact, there was a recovery. There has been a recovery. Here's the problem with the recovery. 92% of it went to the wealthy, to the top 10%. Why is that? So there was a recovery. Don't say there wasn't a recovery. It's just we didn't all get part of it. Now, why? Because under this new paradigm, that's the way it works. What we have now is we have a feudal system where the money goes to the top. Whether it's corporations, the fact that a few corporations control everything is nothing but a reflection of our social structure. And that's what we have. And unless we change something structurally, this is not a jobless recovery. This is a recovery in which the money all goes exactly where it's designed to go to Mitt Romney and his cronies. And you think it's bad now. If this guy gets in, he's going to finish it. There may be a few crumbs left for Terry. We might have a crumb left, and I think he wants to snatch that crumb up and eat it.
I have no doubt. I have no doubt that if Romney gets elected, and also I frankly think if Obama does, the economy is going to tank again. Mark?
Well, No. Look, here's what I like that Joe Biden did and that Barack Obama needs to do tonight. And if you don't know, if you just tuned in, we are on all the way up till 9 o'clock tonight. So please continue to listen to Raucous Caucus, and then we're going to play the debate right here on your Pacifica station. So wherever you're driving, keep driving. You won't miss a word of the debate, and you won't miss a word of our sagacity all the way up until 9 o'clock. But here's what Barack Obama has to do tonight. Joe Biden, and he was lucky to go up against Paul Ryan, because Paul Ryan typified everything that's wrong with Republicans in Congress. And it just helps that he's a leader of the Republicans in Congress. Because to the extent that President Obama did not succeed in the economy, and we know the economy is not where we want it to be, but to the extent that he did not succeed, it's because he had the party of no standing in his way, filibustering everything he tried to do, from the Jobs Act and the infrastructure bills to his plans to whether it's from reforming the deficit to the Dream Act, whatever it was, the Republicans were standing in his way every step of the way. And what I think President Obama has to make clear, and it frankly would help elect more Democrats in Congress, is that the only reason he didn't succeed as far as he wanted to is because of Republicans standing in his way. He has to do what Harry Truman did. Run against Congress,
right,
particularly against the Republican Congress.
Yep.
And I hope
he really needs to do that in terms of getting congressional support, because if he doesn't have congressional support, nothing is going to happen. And I want to throw in one other idea about the economy, and I wish, you know, Obama would pick up on this, and that is simply changing the language. There's an excellent new book out called, what the heck is it called? Don't Buy It is the title of the book. And it's by a woman named Anat Shenker Osorio.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating book. And she talks about the language that we're caught in. It's the same kind of thing that I was talking about in terms of the war. We're caught in a warlike language. We're caught in a language about the economy that doesn't really reflect the truth. And she suggests that instead of talking about, recovery and all that, we should be saying things such as, and here's one of her quotes, markets malfunction, regulation makes markets function.
A good point. You know, Terry, it's interesting you say that, because one of the great myths that's used by the right wing is a term they use constantly. The free market will decide.
Yeah, right.
The free market. That's a myth, because the market is not free. The market is highly manipulated, as was demonstrated in the 2008 crash.
Even Adam Smith, author of The Wealth of Nations, 1776, the guy who coined the term invisible hand and laissez-faire and free market, said right in that book that no one ever reads but everybody quotes, that you need to have a government-regulated system to allow that invisible hand to work.
Well,
there is no such thing as a completely free market. Never.
And there's so many ways that the language could be changed. You know, we could be not talking about that word recovery, because that's a doom word. You know, recovery means you're dying, right? You know, we could restore our economy. Positive language that Obama could be using, and I sure hope he uses it tonight.
Yeah, but I think with all that being said, I think that there has to be structural change, because what we have and what we have created, and I say we, it didn't happen under Barack Obama. It's happened over the last, and it didn't just happen under George Bush. It's happened over the last 30 years. What we have created is a type of feudal society where the problem is not that our economy doesn't work. The problem is that it works very, very well. It works. The problem, it's like George Bush. George Bush turned around, what, $9 trillion? There was like a four point something trillion dollar surplus when he came in, and he left a $5 trillion deficit. He turned around $9 trillion, and people say, oh my gosh, that's terrible. No, it's not terrible. Oh, he was a bad president. No, he was very good at what he was trying to do, which was redirect the money up to the wealthy. So the problem, I say, is our economy, and that's the problem with most people looking at our economy, thinking it's broken and it doesn't work. The problem is it doesn't work. It has to be changed so that it works differently.
And probably
here's my question.
And again, this gets to the honesty, and I wish these guys would be honest about it, and I wish Obama would be honest. The only way that you're going to check that is probably through the International Monetary Fund. It can't be checked by one country by itself, because the super rich and the huge corporations can simply ignore any given country and spend the money where they want to spend it, invest where they want to invest, find the cheapest labor no matter what the conditions. You need the IMF. You need international cooperation, which Americans are xenophobic about. How the heck do we get past that, Mark?
Well, I'd like to ask our listeners to help, but we're moving into the point where our listeners are going to call in at 202-588-0893 and ask the questions that they would ask at a town hall meeting of both Obama and Romney. And my question for our listeners is, what kinds of questions do you think should be asked by people tonight that actually show the difference between them? We get callers all the time that say, oh, they're all the same. What questions do you think are the best ones to elucidate the differences between the two of them on the economy, on the Middle East, on abortion or immigration or climate change or whatever issue it is that most concerns you, health care? What questions should be asked? Because it's going to be interesting when they ask, you know, all these town hall people, and we're going to hear some really good questions, and we're probably going to hear a bunch of stupid questions too. So
those will probably come from Terry, Mark.
The question would be, but what's the strategy for answering the questions? Because I got to tell you, if they come off with Obama saying, you're lying, Romney, I'm telling you the truth, and Romney saying, you're lying, Obama, I'm telling you the truth, then for that 6% that has no idea who they're voting for, they're just going to be, I don't know what to do, throw up their hands and probably not vote.
Let me give you
How do you persuade in that context?
Let me give out the number again, 202-588-0893. We're 89.3 FM, so it's easy to remember. 202-588-0893. Call in. And what we'd like you to do is give us, how about this? Give us one question that you would ask, the president and one question that you would ask Romney. We're going to hopefully have a lot of callers, so we don't have time. Now let me
let me
make an announcement, guys.
Let me throw in a little structure, guys, because I know we're going to get good calls.
Yeah, we're starting to fill up, guys.
As always. Let's just sort of, you know, we've only got a couple of phone lines tonight that we're going to have available. So if you can't get through, just keep on trying because we will get you on the air if there's any way possible. And once we get that question, let's each of us respond and then just go right on to the next caller, okay?
Okay, guys.
And actually, Garland, whenever there's a line open, just say line open and
okay.
People will know they can call
in. And guys, I have a big announcement to make.
Uh-oh.
On the line now, we have Nathan. Now, let me just say this to Nathan. I'm sure you can hear me. Nathan, we're having a discussion. If you just start yelling and calling names, we're going to cut you off. We want to have a discussion with you, but no yelling and calling names.
What if it's a different Nathan?
Nathan?
Call me up. I'm gone. Like cowards, talk to me while I'm on the phone instead of hanging up on me.
We're here, Nathan. We said we want to have a discussion with you.
That's right. But
Nathan, what question would you ask
of
Obama and Romney?
Okay, yeah, let's go. Let's go for it. We got a lot of people waiting, Nathan. What questions would you ask him?
The question I would ask Obama is, why is he killing innocent women in charge of these drones? And Romney, I want to ask him, what would he do different than Obama? Because Obama doing the same thing that Bush did. He's killing up people with drones. He's killing up the people in the Middle East.
So you would ask,
both of them. Y'all cheerleading him like he's some kind of.
So Nathan, let's have a discussion here. Well, cut him off. Cut. See you later, Nathan. We tried, didn't
can't
we, guys?
Can't have a discussion.
No, they yeah. didn't.
Nathan something. Can't have a discussion. He can only have a one-way rant.
And we got a line open, 202-588-0893. Call
yeah,
on in.
You know,
we got another line open.
Guys, we can't ignore the topic entirely because his question has validity. This drone warfare is a frightening, frightening military departure from everything that we've understood about. I mean, all war is hell, but now we've got a nice way of making it hell by the push of a button. And somehow there is a drone issue, which is totally not, again, unregulated and not dealt with in the world. There are no treaties about drones. There's no understanding between nations on how drones should use or should not be used. Every nation in the country is manufacturing or acquiring drones. That's an issue that has to be addressed. Nathan's right about that.
I agree.
Drones in the way that we use any weapons of war, that we go after military targets, that we don't go after civilian targets, that we go where there's actionable intelligence that someone is, you know, trying to kill us. We go to the terrorist training base, Osama bin Laden. I'm fine with giving him and his friends some drones, but we have to be very, very careful and very precise. And it's fair to ask specifically, you know, where the drones have gone and to what extent have they been successful and to what extent have they killed innocent people.
Let me agree with Terry here, and then we've got another. And that is this: I do think there needs to be an international agreement on drones, just as we had the Geneva Convention for this reason. It's easy for us to say, oh, well, you know, drones, and we're using them. Why? Because we have the military power and might to do what we will or may. What happens if another country develops some kind of drones or whatever it is, and they start flying them across the, you know, Reston, Virginia, and blasting
Hezbollah
some...
I'm
talking about the United States. What happens when Russia or some other superpower or China decides they want to fly our drone because there's somebody, one of the guys that they don't like in America is in Reston or is in Baltimore, and a drone flies across from China and they blow up a city block and they kill 10 or 20 or 30 Americans because they had a Chinese dissident that they wanted to get. We're not going to be happy about it. I agree with Terry.
That's true.
I think that we need an international, because just because we're the bullies on the block, we can use them. And of course, we're going to say it's all right the way we're using them, because we're not the ones getting blasted. AU, are you there? IU,
yeah.
AU?
I'm here, yeah. Hi, how are you?
Wonderful.
Interesting conversation.
What would you ask?
If I say a little piece and then go to the question. I heard Mark insisting that we help the Syrian people. And we have learned from the Arab Spring and what happened in Syria, Tunisia, and I don't know, whatever they tell you, they didn't build any democracy over there. But what I'm talking about, what I'm interested in is, if you help the opposition, and as some sources clearly demonstrate, that this opposition are maybe, you know, if not fully, considerably infiltrated by Al-Qaeda elements, you going in with armaments, arming them, you are already doing that. What proportion of the Syrian people are you talking about? We are helping the Syrian people. When it was found out that this opposition who are running here and there are torturing or mass murdering, you know, their enemies or the friends of... Really, I don't understand. Coming from Mark or people from this side of the aisle, I am really disappointed because I don't like it. The other statement is this Iranian thing. They build an enemy and we go along. They built Saddam Hussein one time as a friend, another time as an enemy. We went along and the 4,000-year civilization is completely wiped out. Billions of dollars are given to, you know, whatever you call them, contractors, whatever. They are killing on behalf of this government and the people. I'm really frustrated.
I appreciate your question. I appreciate the way it was phrased. And yeah. I want to be very clear. I am concerned about the Al-Qaeda elements that are in the opposition. I know they're there, and I'm not blind to that. But I also have had on my radio show, I've talked to a number of people in the Syrian Free Army, and it's very clear to me that they are all walks of life. They are young and old. They are students. They are Shia and Sunni and Christian and all walks of life in Syria. As far as I'm concerned, Al-Qaeda will be more likely to get these dangerous weapons if we do nothing than if we help. I think if we help, we can actually help the people win, and they don't need to rely on Al-Qaeda. If we do nothing and the people are being massacred, they will turn to Al-Qaeda, and that means it's much more likely that once they get rid of Assad, that Al-Qaeda will be a hero rather than America being the hero. As far as I'm concerned, the war will continue and the massacre will continue. It's not a question of whether the war will happen or not. It's a question of whether America will be on the right side of history or whether Al-Qaeda will be the people who liberate the Syrian people. And I'd rather be
us. The silly thing about it to me is we keep on demanding that the premier resign, you know, and he probably shouldn't, he leave. But that's the only tactic we seem to have, that plus, you know, sanctions. How do we bring this war to the end? And that's the question that should be brought to Obama and to Romney.
It's a great question, and neither of them have an answer.
And speaking of questions, we've got Nas.
They don't have an answer.
We've got Nas. Nas, welcome to the Raucous Caucus.
Hi, how are you?
I am just wonderful. And what questions would you ask our candidates, Nas?
The first question actually would be for Romney. Please forgive me, I lost my voice slightly.
No problem.
I understand about this mortgage crisis that's happening. I would like to know his approach outside of what seems to be, and I don't want to put my foot in my mouth, but it seems like mortgages, that American dream of home ownership, is becoming less and less of a reality because what's happening is, and maybe this is the only solution, people are having issues paying their mortgages, of course. But the government is coming in and saying, okay, we'll pretty much buy back your mortgage from you in a sense that you become then a renter instead of an owner. And what happens if in the case that the person can't pay the rent anymore? Mm-hmm. Does that whole dream of potentially regaining momentum to home ownership status back to paying a regular mortgage, does that just get snatched away? Or what other solutions is he willing to offer people?
And what question would you ask Governor Romney?
That was from Governor Romney.
She doesn't have much I know.
It's a good question, you know. But again,
I think it's a great question.
But I already know the answer. Obama and Romney have to get honest with us. The fact is, besides everything else that went on that was manipulative and everything else, is that America, against all statistics and all studies, overpushed home ownership, pushed it to an absurd, excessive degree. Yes, it sounds all beautiful to have the American dream and everything else, but it's very easy to study these things or to read the studies on these things and understand that economically it makes sense for many people to rent not to purchase homes. Yeah, at different stages.
And I'm going to push back against Terry, too, Mark.
The first thing that has to happen is, one, regulate the banks. Two, the mortgages that are out there should be reconfigured so that the interest rate is lowered and even the principal lowered to reflect the market value. And if you did those two things, then you would restore a market. It's as simple as that. Will Obama say that? Will Romney say that? I doubt it.
Mark?
Here's the thing. There have been two schools of thought, and they're both right.
Two.
There were some people who should not have been homeowners, who just took advantage of the crazy prices that were crazy. They were so crazy, the whole thing collapsed. They were being offered to people. But I don't think that's the majority. I think that's 2, 3, 5%. Everyone can point to anecdotal cases. The vast majority of Americans that could afford their homes could afford their mortgages. It's just that when their housing prices dropped 30, 40%, suddenly something that was affordable wasn't affordable anymore, and they're underwater. And the dirty little secret about foreclosures that banks don't want to let you know is that foreclosures are expensive, and legal proceedings are expensive. And it actually makes sense. It makes sense as a matter of a bottom line for banks to let the homeowner stay in the home and continue paying the mortgage at a lower rate than to foreclose on them and try to find a buyer in a market that's depressed.
Right, and the other part.
There's room here. There's room for compromise.
Totally.
There's room. But here's my point. There is room for the banks to make money and for people to stay in their homes, and it's by, yes, lowering the principal, but no bank will do it without government force. And the reason they won't do it is if they lower it on their books, and they have to tell all their shareholders that they have less equity, and that makes their stock price collapse.
And here's
so what President Obama has done is a number of mortgage programs that the Republicans in Congress have not allowed him to pursue. And that's why we're stymied here. Yeah. And I've never heard a solution from Romney. Obama's solutions have been stymied, and Romney has no solution.
Even
Obama has never said reconfigure.
Romney has had a solution. You're wrong, Mark. His solution was let them all go under. In case you've forgotten, he had a solution.
Right.
Let them all go under. Let everybody suffer. Let them eat cake. Alan, welcome to WPFW.
Yeah, my question to both candidates is very simple. How do you sleep at night knowing that you are the vampires sucking the blood, both of you sucking the blood out of the poor and working people, and F the middle class because they're not where it's at? No, I don't mean F the middle class, but stop kissing the ass of the middle class and start talking about the poor and oppressed people. Both of y'all are bloodsuckers and vampires. How do you sleep at night?
202-588-0893. That's 202-588-0893.
Anyone's going to call them vampires.
No.
But I think Alan's point, I think he was venting. Toned it down about 20 levels.
He was venting.
His point, which is don't just talk about the middle class, what about the poor, is a great point. I don't think anyone at Town Hall will call them vampires or bloodsuckers. That ain't going to happen.
And the other thing, that's a good point that he made and a good point that you guys are following up on, and that is that the discussion of the poor, the underclass, the economic underclass in America, basically, they don't exist. There is no discussion. They're not discussed on, you know, you turn on the mainstream cable news or the media, they're not discussed. You turn on, you look at the candidate, the people who have no finance, who have no economic power, they have no political power, they are not discussed. You know, they are just, whoa, guess what? Guys, this is important. We got Isaac. Isaac, welcome to WPFW. Isaac?
Hey, what's up, guys?
Hey, we're great to have you.
Hey,
great to have you. What's happening, Isaac? What questions would you ask our candidates tonight?
I would ask both of them, would either of them be
Turn your radio down. Turn your radio down. It's going to mess us all up.
Would either of them
feedback
be in favor of eliminating the Federal Reserve?
Whoa.
I don't think either of them would be in favor of eliminating the Federal Reserve.
Given the fact that
the question is whether to regulate the Federal Reserve or not,
that has the power to print the money of the nation, would either of them be in favor of eliminating the Federal Reserve and giving the right to the people to print and bank their own money.
That's but an easy one. Isaac, no,
do you
neither
think
of them
every American
would.
Should have the right to print money? I got to push back on you a little bit here. If the Federal Reserve doesn't do it, does that mean, Isaac, you have a printing press and I have a printing press and we all just write our money down on little scraps of paper? I mean, what are you advocating here?
Well, I mean, the money that we use today is basically valueless.
It's
basically
valueless. I can get stuff with it. When I go to a restaurant and I order a hamburger and I give them this little green thing that says $10 on it, they give me a hamburger.
They give you a hamburger, but the value of that money is basically worthless.
Well, let me say this, Isaac. I understand what you're saying, and it is popular amongst a lot of people to say we should get rid of the Federal Reserve. And I'm not saying that it's right or wrong. I don't think so. But here's the issue.
I mean,
here's my issue.
When he signed that into law, he said that was the worst thing that he'd ever done.
But here's my issue, Isaac.
Against the people.
You can't.
By giving that power to the Fed to print our money.
Now, Isaac, hear me out. Hear me out, Isaac. Are you there? I guess he wouldn't want to hear me out. Okay, here's my point, since Isaac doesn't want to kind of have a conversation here. When people say, get rid of the Federal Reserve, you know, that's a very simple solution to an extremely complex issue. You can't just walk up today and say, what are you going to do to my car? You know, it's not running right. Pull the engine out. Well, your car's not going to run anymore. People say, let's get rid of the Federal Reserve without having an alternate plan. If tomorrow we just said, you know what, let's close the Federal Reserve down, we'd all fall into a worldwide depression. We can't. Our economy would fall apart and somebody else's would. I mean, and we'd take the rest of the world down with us, really. So you can't say that.
At the very least, you know, but what should be
without an alternate plan.
Too, is one, the reserve should be audited. You know,
That's
two,
fair.
It needs to be more closely regulated. It can't be as independent as it is. Mm-hmm. And three, maybe we should stop, you know, putting heads of banks as the board members of the Federal Reserve.
Yeah.
And that's the point, Kerry. There are all kinds of reforms that can and should be done to the Federal Reserve. And I would suggest to people who are critical of the Federal Reserve, rather than say end it, which is kind of like saying end war or end the military or end evil, you have nothing to replace. Or the people, frankly, who say end Obamacare, right, or end Dodd-Frank, and they have no idea what they can replace it with. If instead of saying end it, you say reform it, audit it more, make its board more democratic, if you come up with its reforms, that's something that's actually possible and doable. End it is, to me, just rhetoric.
We've got Gabriel here, 202-588-0893. We're going to break at the top of the hour, but we're going to be here for another hour between 8 and 9, 202-588-0893. Gabriel, welcome to WPFW.
Yes, how you doing?
Wonderful.
We're doing fine.
And what questions would you ask our candidates?
I'm young right now. I'm only 27, okay? And with the insurance plans that they have, I want to know what's going to happen with me if I have, when I get to the age where, you know, I'm like, you know, 77 or 80 years old, and I have a terminal illness, what will be my options? Is it just hospice, or will Medicare be able to go ahead and pay for what I've been paying into the system my whole life?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
It's a great question.
Part of what Romney has no answer for.
Well, you know, I'm
Romney's
not sure Obama
answer
does
for
either.
You.
I mean, you know.
Well, no, except, Obama has an answer. Obama.
No. Except, you know, either we're going to go to a single-payer system, a one-payer system, you know, and where everybody is insured, a universal system, so that everybody shares the load no matter what stage they're at. Either we go to that, or in fact, and here's again where they're not getting honest, in fact, you are going to be left out. You know, there's no question about it, because economically it's not sustainable as it is.
Mark.
I don't feel like either one of them is being honest on where they're going to be able to cover me, or I have to go ahead and just go with my own, you know?
Mm-hmm,
is it just going to be,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
if I want to prolong my life, you know,
Romney
my loved ones want
Romney
to still
was
here,
asked that question,
you know?
And he said, go to the emergency room.
Yeah,
Romney
right.
believes
yeah.
in emergency
so hard to
room
do when you're dying.
Healthcare, even though it costs 6, 10, 20 times as much as preventative care does.
Yeah, the other thing about it is this.
It's no longer an option. It's either go home, go to a nursing home, or hospice.
And
you know, is the government still going to be able to take care of me because I paid into this system?
Yeah,
or am I going to be left out to hang to dry?
And, you know, and that's a great question. And let me just tag on to what Terry said. The bottom line, I agree with you 100%, Terry, that we talk about saving Medicare till 2016 or 2024. Let's talk about 30, 40 years from now. The bottom line is the cost of medical care is rising so fast, and it's not going to stop rising, that the time will come, and we're not that far away, Medicare, Schmedicare. It won't be, the average person or even the above average person will not be able to afford Medicare. Medical care in this country. I believe we will get to a time when either it's going to be single payer, either the government is going to handle medical coverage, or only a tiny, tiny group of people will be able to get it. And that just ain't going to work socially.
And the only What has to happen is single payer and everybody paying.
Because I agree.
There's no other way you can share the load. You can, in fact, if government, you know, were doing this and providing Medicare to everybody, you can then, in fact, negotiate prices with insurance companies, or not even with insurance companies, to hell with insurance companies. And you may quote me, but they can negotiate prices with hospitals, they can negotiate prices with doctors, they can negotiate prices with pharmaceuticals.
We're at the top of the hour, guys.
Understanding of what treatments are needed, and stop using stupid phrases like death squads, because that's not what it's about.
We are at the